And recognize the very strong feelings that the 18 million people who voted for me had.
A recent Wall Street Journal poll indicates only about half of Clinton supporters plan to vote for Obama. Clinton also deflected all questions about possibly becoming the vice presidential running mate to the Obama campaign. For NPR News, I'm Phil Latzman in Miami.
Authorities say the powder contained in a threatening letter sent to Republican John McCain's campaign office in a Denver suburb was not hazardous, and that a second letter sent to a McCain office in New Hampshire was a false alarm. Colorado officials say an inmate suspected of sending the letters from a detention center may face federal felony charges. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Freestyle Releasing, presenting Bottle Shock, the true story of a Napa Valley wine tasting competition, starring Alan Rickman, Bill Pullman, and Freddie Rodriguez.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible by the University of Illinois School of Music, presenting the Allerton Music Barn Festival, August 29th through September 1st at Allerton Park. More information is at www.allertonmusicbarn.com.
Do you have a question about digital radio or digital TV? Come to the WILL Digital Information Fair and Open House this Sunday from 2 to 4:30 at 300 North Goodwin, Urbana. Get your questions answered, tour Campbell Hall, meet our on-air hosts, and enter to win a digital TV or digital radio. We hope to see you this Sunday at Campbell Hall.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this first hour, we'll be talking about the recent conflict in the Caucasus involving the governments of Georgia, its two breakaway regions, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and also Russia. This is something that began as a local conflict between the governments of Georgia and the forces in this breakaway region, South Ossetia, but it became something much larger when Russia intervened and sent troops into Georgia. Now, there are reports this morning that say the Russians have begun to withdraw their troops, but at the same time, the Russian military says that it is planning to maintain a military presence in Georgia. This morning, we'll talk a little bit about the roots of this conflict and also talk about what it means for all of the parties involved and also for relations between Russia and the West. And our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Richard Tempest. He is Associate Professor of Slavic Languages and Literatures here at University of Illinois and is also Director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. And we're pleased to have him here in the studio with us. Questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is that people try to be brief in their questions and comments, but they are welcome. You can be a part of the conversation by calling us. And the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here you'd like to join in, you certainly are welcome to call. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. I think that some people have observed that there has been tension between the governments of Russia and Georgia for some time now, at least going back to the election of Mr. Saakashvili, who is the current president of Georgia. And in fact, some people, I think, have said that the conflict that we have just seen explode over the last 3 weeks or so was somehow inevitable, that it was just something that was waiting to happen. Do you think that that's the case?
I think so. Along the periphery of the former Soviet Union, there are a number of so-called frozen conflicts, ethnic problems that were left over from the collapse of the Soviet Union. In part, it had to do with the way in which the Soviet Union was structured administratively. It was divided into union republics, all of which became independent, and also autonomous republics, some of which were retained by Russia, others became part of the newly independent states. And one could describe some of these conflicts as time bombs, which were left by Stalin, the late Soviet dictator who ruled Russia and the Soviet Union for much of the 20th century. So now what we have is after effects of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the problems which were not resolved at the time because they were so difficult, because there were so many competing forces, these problems are now surfacing.
This is something that, I think that I've only come to understand is that – and at least I think that this is the case, is that if you go back to the Soviet Union time, that what the government in Moscow did was they actually cultivated groups like this, and that there are parallel kinds of conditions in some of the other places that were formerly Soviet republics, in Ukraine, in Moldova, and that I think the image that I settled on was landmine, but time bomb is probably a pretty good thing too. And one wonders, could we see something like this happening in some other places?
Unfortunately, the answer is yes. It is a possibility. I'll give you a couple of examples. For instance, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine became independent. They voted for independence just before the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the borders of Ukraine were drawn in such a way that they included a very large number, millions of Russian speakers, people with a Russian, not only linguistic identity, but ethnic identity. Also, the Crimea, which is a peninsula on the Black Sea, was transferred to the Ukrainian Union Republic by Nikita Khrushchev, Stalin's successor, Soviet leader, in the 1950s as a kind of birthday gift to Ukraine in 1954. That territory, historically, has been considered by the Russians, and I think with some legitimacy, as part of the Russian cultural and historical space, even though, at the same time, under Stalin, the population of the native Tatar population of the Crimea was deported in 1944 for alleged collaboration with the Germans during World War II. So that's just a little example of how many conflicts superimpose one upon the other. One has, just in the case of Ukraine, you also mentioned the Transnistria region in Moldova. That's an enclave which is governed by a pro-Russian separatist leader. And Moldova, which, interesting enough, is governed by communists, but which wishes to join the European Union, has been trying for years to reincorporate the Transnistria region into Moldova. But the Russians, who have military forces there and support the separatists, have prevented that from happening. And again, the other thing to remember is that it's very difficult to say, in the case of all these conflicts, who's in the right and who's in the wrong. If we look at Ossetia, for example, South Ossetia is part legally, internationally recognized, as part of the Georgian Republic. North Ossetia, which is inhabited by people of exactly the same ethnicity and historical background, is part of the Russian Federation. It is natural, in a sense, for the South Ossetians to wish to join with the North Ossetians, especially because there are some old ethnic resentments between the Georgians and the Ossetians, which I don't want to go into right now, since that would require a very long lesson in history. But one might say that they have a point. On the other hand, South Ossetia also had, until very recently, a large Georgian population. These people were victims of the conflict between the Georgian authorities and the Ossetian separatists, South Ossetian separatists, which erupted as the Soviet Union collapsed. Some of them were ethnically cleansed. Others remained in South Ossetia. But now we learn, in fact, right in front of the eyes of the Finnish foreign minister, there were reports that Russian trucks were shipping ethnic Georgians from the villages in Ossetia and disembarking them right under his eyes, in front of him, just a few hours ago. Mm-hmm. So there apparently is ethnic cleansing, or at least there is a tendency on the part of the remaining Georgians in South Ossetia to leave their homes, whether because of ethnic persecution or a sense of insecurity, or perhaps because of policy expulsion by whoever's in charge in South Ossetia.
Well, these two regions that we're talking about, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, they're parts of Georgia, but they border on Russia. They have people there who identify themselves as Georgians, but then they also have people who say, no, they're Ossetians and they're Abkhaz. And they say, first of all, I'm sure those people would say, we are not Georgians. We don't want to have anything to do with Georgia. It wasn't our idea to be part of Georgia. And they are, in a sense, sort of gravitating towards Russia. Does that mean that they identify with the Russians, or does that just mean that what they don't want to have anything to do with Georgia? So, you know, what's their other choice is to, and because the Russians have kind of weighed in on their side, you know, they're just going with whoever is the biggest guy on the block, and that obviously would be Moscow.
Well, there's a question with a number of answers, or one very complicated and involved answer. What I can tell you is that the South Ossetians are ethnically very different from the Georgians, and indeed from the Russians. Now, they consider themselves a separate ethnic group, obviously, but they would also like to be independent. As would the people living in Abkhazia. The Russians, in fact, are not very keen on this at all because they don't want another microstate on their southern border, which is the Caucasus, a very unsettled region, as we all know. What the Russians did in the early 90s after the first armed conflict between the Georgian authorities and the South Ossetian separatists, they handed out Russian passports to the South Ossetians, which gave them the opportunity to travel abroad and gave them a different political identity from the Georgian one. The same happened elsewhere in the other breakaway regions of Georgia. But the leader of South Ossetia, or the leadership, let's say, of South Ossetia, as I said, would ideally like to be independent of both Russia and Georgia, because they have their own issues with the Russians. The Russians being a great power, and what we have now in this part of the world is a rerun, if you like, of the 19th century so-called Great Game, when Britain and Russia, mostly Britain and Russia, used the various tribes and states between the Russian Empire and the British Empire as pawns on this political chessboard. So for the Russians, the United States has a client. From a Russian point of view, the client is Georgia, and they feel that Georgia's desire to enter the European Union, but especially to join NATO, is a direct infringement of their interests, Russia's interests. They very much dislike President Saakashvili, for reasons which are not only geopolitical, not only because his policy is inimical, as the Russians see it, to their interests, but also because Saakashvili, who is a very temperamental, shall we say, leader, a young man, an able man, but also one who is a bit of a orator, and the Russians call him, of course, a demagogue, has in the past personally insulted President Putin. The Russians have answered in kind, so there's a degree of animosity, personal animosity, which is also, to some extent, driving this conflict.
Yeah. We have a caller here. I'd like to bring them in, and also, for anybody who's just tuned in, introduce again our guest, Richard Tempest. He is Associate Professor of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the U of I and is Director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center at the U of I. And we're talking about what has happened, been happening recently in Georgia. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. First caller is here in Champaign County, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. You've pointed out the mutability of borders, and it seems to me that it's fairly ironic that we have both sides of the political spectrum in the United States agitating about territorial integrity when a lot of these lines were drawn by the revolutionary so-called Soviet Union. Lehrauer last night had a piece, a backgrounder on Afghanistan, and they said that Abkhazia was attached to Georgia in 31 or so by explicitly by the Georgian patriarch Stalin, and that Ossetia was split off right at the time of the Russian Revolution, probably at the behest of Stalin as well. So we have this idea that the territorial integrity involves protecting this kind of thing. I think you'll want to react to that. But I wanted to ask about NATO. I think you were just sort of getting around to the broader dimensions of it. I've been going back to the arguments about NATO that expansion was passed in the Clinton era. There were these representations made by Baker. He doesn't like to talk about it when he was Secretary of State, that there wouldn't be an expansion into the old Soviet bloc, that it would go as far. This was part of the deal for the unification of the West and East Germany. Now, none of this was passed by any kind of parliament. I guess Yeltsin might have been able to get it through after he bombed the parliament or something. But are rescinding it, I guess, could have gotten passed. But it seems to me that we need to talk about that. George F. Kennan, who was an architect of the containment policy, came out of semi-retirement, I guess, in the late 90s to agitate. He called it expanding NATO into the near abroad of Russia would be, he said something like, I'm trying to find the quote here, large foreign policy blunder. Let's put that as a paraphrase. So there's you can't find anyone that suggests that now. It seems that Biden was ushering it through the Congress at that time, and McCain was certainly right there. And it just seems to me that we need to talk about that. This is not an apology for any of the superpowers. It seems to me they all have their and it's always the grass gets trampled by the elephants in the African proverb. That's not a question, but I'd like to hear some response on that, if you could.
Oh, well, thank you for this very thoughtful and informed comments. I'll address the two themes that you raised. The first, the territorial integrity of Georgia. The Russians have recently said, no less a figure than Foreign Minister Lavrov of Russia, has indicated that Georgian territorial integrity was no longer a consideration for the Russians. Now, arguably, one could say that this is a dangerous development because, as I already indicated, there are any number of ethnic conflicts and ethnic injustices, if you like, scattered across the length and breadth of the former Soviet Union. And this, of course, sets a precedent. I remind my listeners of what happened in Africa. When the European colonial powers carved up Africa, they drew straight lines on the map, dividing tribes and communities in two and three sometimes. And there was much unhappiness. Much of what is happening, what's happened in Africa since, the economic and ethnic problems can be traced back to the way in which the continent was divided among the great European powers. In Russia, you have a somewhat similar situation, rather in the former Soviet Union, with borders arbitrarily drawn, ethnic groups divided between different territorial units, which are now independent, South Ossetia and North Ossetia, case in point. The question is, if one starts revising these borders, where does one stop? I mean, in Africa, I think Eritrea was a recent example of borders being redrawn by the newly independent post-colonial states, Ethiopia, recognized Eritrean independence. And also in the Sudan, we have South Sudan, which has been promised independence by the northern government. In Africa, it's been limited, and this territorial revision is probably a good thing too. One has to see whether Russia, which is, of course, the preeminent successor state to the former Soviet Union, whether Russia will restrain itself or whether the temptation will be to start redrawing other borders and trying to reincorporate certain Russian minorities or certain enclaves that exist outside Russia's borders, but which to which Russia can lay some kind of historical or ethnic claim or political claim. That's the first point. The second point about NATO accession, you're right, at the time that NATO was expanded, and this happened during the Clinton administration, it was in fact a fairly, I wouldn't say controversial, but there were voices raised, some of them very influential, against doing this. And it was done, however, and now it's a established fact. True, though, that Georgia would be a country. Georgia is a transcontinental state. Actually, it lies both within Europe and Asia, so that would be an important departure. Also, unlike the Baltic states, which were formerly part of the Soviet Union, but were incorporated into the Soviet Union by force in 1940, Georgia's relationship with Russia historically has been much closer. And strategically also, there are considerations of oil, supplies of oil. And also, just the Russia is a very different country now. It's much more powerful, much more self-confident than it was in the 1990s. And it feels that their point of view is that they want to reassert their status as a great power. Not a superpower. They don't have those illusions anymore. But certainly as a great power, as a power that has legitimate geopolitical interests in its own near abroad, the term the Russians use to describe the states bordering on Russia, the former states of the Soviet Union. One has to be very careful. One has to take into account Russian sensibilities, I think. But also, at the same time, there is the case that Georgia is an independent state, and it has the right to conduct its own foreign policy. But at the same time, that policy should be conducted in a way that is responsible. And I cannot say with complete or even partial confidence that Saakashvili's government has acted very responsibly, very cleverly in this situation. It takes a peculiar set of political skills to make Putin look good in a situation of ethnic conflict and war. And Saakashvili has been able to achieve that. He has had a very good press in the West in general, in the United States in particular. He speaks very good English. He knows the United States very well. He has been able to offer, if you like, a plot, a narrative to which Americans respond instinctively with great sympathy, plucky little state being bombarded and crushed by enormous Russian empire, the huge Russian bear. But as is so often the case in these territories, in these areas bordering the Soviet Union, things are much more complicated. As I tell my students sometimes, there can be such a thing as too much history, and there is too much history in the Caucasus, where Georgia and Russia are right now confronting each other.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I have somebody else I want to get to. We're already at our midpoint here. Our guest is Richard Tempest. He is director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center at University of Illinois. We're talking about current events in Georgia. Just to follow up on that, and if the Savoy caller won't mind waiting for just a moment, one of the big questions here, certainly in my mind, and I think in many minds, is what was it that Mr. Saakashvili was thinking when on August 7th he made this attack into South Ossetia and in fact attacked Shkinvali, the capital of South Ossetia. Now, I think probably depending on who you ask, somebody's going to say, well, the Russians started it, the Georgians started it. Depending on who you are and what your interests are, you're going to point the finger particular ways. But it seems as if the precipitating event was indeed the Georgian military move into South Ossetia. Why, given the fact that there was such a potential for touching off a wider conflict, why did he do this?
Short answer, the Olympic Games. What happened was that the attack occurred, actually was timed to occur, apparently, with the opening ceremony of the Olympics. Putin and President Bush and Prime Minister Putin were both at the opening of the Olympics. Many observers believe that Saakashvili felt this was a good time to make a move, to reoccupy South Ossetia. One has to remember that this is not the first breakaway part of Georgia that he has tried to reincorporate into his country's territory. This also happened in the case of Adjara, which is another ethnic territory which was nominally, unofficially independent, run by separatists and reincorporated earlier during Saakashvili's tenure as president. But I think in this case, he made a calculation, if you like, a piece of low cunning, that the Russians will be too flabbergasted by what had happened, and that he will be able to present them and the world with a fait accompli. It didn't work out that way. And one could argue that he actually played into the Russians' hands. One has to remember that there was constant shelling on both sides. There was bad blood on both sides. It's certainly not the Georgians don't bear all the responsibility for the conflict, nor do the South Ossetians, nor do, in fact, the Russians. But if you take the kind of broader view, the larger view, but in the case of the actual war that occurred, this seven-day war between Russia and Georgia, all indications are that the Georgians made the first move, and they did it trying to achieve strategic surprise.
All right. Let's go to Savoy, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Do you happen to know if the South Ossetians are the ethnic Greek Pontans who were exiled by the Turks before World War I and sought refuge in that area from Russia?
I believe the Ossetians are people who are were well established in the Caucasus for hundreds of years. And I'm not familiar, actually, with the historical incident that you refer to, but the Ossetians have been present in that part of the world for many years, hundreds of years, and have had, if you like, a certain amount of history, both with the Georgians and also with some other tribes to the north, some other ethnic groups to the north. It's one of those situations that goes back into the mists of time.
Well, most people don't know about the Pontians who lived along the southern area of the Black Sea, who were exiled just before and at the same time as the Armenians were. And some of them, many of them, came to the United States and all over the world. Some of them went to north around the Black Sea to Russia. And I thought perhaps these were ethnical Greeks because I heard that they were all Orthodox.
That is correct, but so are the Georgians, and so, of course, are the Russians. There is a Greek population in the former Soviet Union, in Russia and in Ukraine, but the Ossetians are a separate ethnic group.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have, I think our first caller would maybe like to have a follow-up, and we don't have any other callers waiting, so we'll do that. Go ahead, line one.
I wanted to get back to the Kennan quote because it seems to be so prescient. And I did also, the other thing about the Ossetians that's peculiar is that they speak a Farsi dialect, apparently, which shows you how amazingly complex the region is, the Caucasus, with all these different, too much history, and history is a nightmare we're trying to wake up from. That's a Joyce quote. But Kennan said that expanding NATO would be the most fateful error of American policy in the entire post-war era. Expanding to the current Russian borders would have an adverse effect on the development of Russian democracy and impel Russian foreign policy in directions decidedly not to our liking. So I don't often quote Kennan admiringly, but I think he was very good in this. And I think this is what we have, and we have both sides of the political divide wanting to poke the bear. And again, I this is no apology for Russian policy, but it seems to me that the U.S. role is not an innocent bystander. I don't want to make too much of the $800,000 that the aid to McCain is, but some people might, and there might be something to that, who actually... The trainers, Georgia was called the only place in the world that had both Russian and American troops stationed
there, and it looks like we're going further in that direction. Actually, Kyrgyzstan apparently has a base that's both a Russian base and a U.S. base, so it's apparently not true. But that's, you know, again, the old Central Asia region, which is the contested great game of the day. The U.S. role of the trainers, there's also Israeli trainers. An Israeli equivalent of Blackwater was involved in training, and apparently the Lavrov has said in the Daily Hindu, it was quoted in the Hindu, that there were mercenaries of various sorts involved in the blitzkrieg on Ossetia from the beginning. Not a lot of press on that, and I don't know if you've seen that or whether you dismissed that, but I think it should be examined at some point by someone.
No, I don't dismiss these reports. Certainly, for example, in Abkhazia, the other enclave, which is governed by separatists within what is officially Georgian territory, in the early 1990s, when the ethnic conflict first broke out, there were Russian mercenaries and there were Chechen mercenaries fighting for Abkhaz independence from Georgia, and there were Georgian there was an ethnic cleansing on the part of Georgians, on the part of the Abkhaz. Similar sorts of things happened in the Ossetia. You can't really say, as far as the ethnic conflict is concerned, who is in the right and who's wrong, because there's so much blood and so much unhappiness inflicted on civilians, in some ways similar to what happened in the Balkans. As far as NATO is concerned, we'll see how this plays out. One of the premises of NATO is that if a country, one of the NATO member states, is attacked by an outside power, then the other NATO states are by treaty obliged to come to that country's, that member's rescue. And should Georgia's bid to join NATO succeed, one imagines that there would have to be some kind of opt-out provision, because certainly until this conflict is resolved, the conflict between Russia and Georgia and South Ossetia and the Georgian authorities, Georgia's membership in NATO could be very problematic. It's another hostage to fortune, if you like. Now, the question of whether the canon, and Richard Pipes, by the way, who was advisor to Reagan during the Reagan administration, and was known as a staunch anti-communist and even accused by some of being anti-Russian. Pipes also protested the idea of NATO expansion in the 1990s. So there were some voices, influential voices, raised against this. But it is a fact now, and it cannot be reversed without a great deal of effort. So one has to deal with the situation as is. And as far as U.S. support for Saakashvili and Georgia, one has to remember that, Georgia does have elections. It's a democracy, not a perfect one, but certainly a democratic state. Saakashvili right now, I would assess, has majority support. Remember that when he was elected to his first term as president, he won something like 94% of the vote, which was absolutely extraordinary, mostly because of the corruption of the previous regime of Shevardnadze. We remember the Rose Revolution, as it was known in Georgia. But things are much tougher now, and of course he has gambled, in a sense, with Georgian lives and Ossetian lives, and with peace in the region. So I'm fairly tough on him, but I think that that's the record. He also has, interestingly enough, a personal relationship with John McCain. He invited Senator McCain to Georgia some time ago, and told him about Georgia, Georgian history. Georgia, of course, has a wonderful ancient history. It was one of the first Christian states anywhere in the world. It was Christianized in the early 4th century. It had relations with the Greeks, the Romans, the Byzantines, Arabs, Persians, Turks, Russians, of course. And all this, I think, has filtered through Saakashvili's very persuasive and articulate discourse, I think, had a certain degree of impact on Senator McCain. But it's not just a question of personalities. Both Senator Obama and Senator McCain, I think, have said pretty much the same thing, that they feel that Georgia has been the victim of Russian aggression. And one could argue whether technically that's correct or not, but certainly there has been a great deal of suffering and bloodshed, mostly on Georgians and the South Ossetians. There has been ethnic cleansing, and certain individuals are responsible for this. What one would hope would happen now is that the United States and Russia together would play a constructive role, restrain and guide their allies, respective allies, and try to reach some kind of understanding. One other final point, the Russians argue that the proclamation of Kosovo independence, the Albanian state of Kosovo in the Balkans, was a paradigm-changing event, and that it made it, therefore, legitimate for the South Ossetians to withdraw from the Georgian Republic, just as the Kosovar Albanians withdrew from the Yugoslav Federation. But the West argument, counter-argument to that, is that Kosovo was a unique case because genocide had been inflicted by the Milosevic regime, the Serbian regime, on the Albanians in Kosovo. Again, genocide is a word that is bandied quite freely in the Caucasus, and both the Georgians and the Ossetians have accused each other of genocide. But toning down the rhetoric in this case might be a good idea.
We have several callers here. We'll try to get in as many as we can, and they are all calling from Urbana, and we'll take them in the order they came in, so that means starting with line two right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The raison d'etre for Putin's involvement in this episode is somewhat similar to the Brezhnev Doctrine, if you remember back on the invasion of Czechoslovakia. It was to support where socialism is threatened. In this case, Putin's doctrine is to support Russians where they're threatened. And in the case of Georgia and southern Ossetia, you don't even need Russians. All you need to do is distribute Soviet passports or Russian passports, and you can have the same effect. And I guess my question is, if there are no Russians in southern Ossetia other than the peacekeepers, what happens in countries like Estonia and the Baltic states? Estonia had a very large Russian population. There were discord for a long period over getting the Russians to learn the language. I'm not sure how many Russian passport holders there still are in Estonia, but I know in the Ukraine, where a third of the population are Russian, east of Dnieper, there are a number of Russian passport holders with far more grounds. Putin could easily threaten intervention in those cases. In fact, any election in the Ukraine is bound to involve the Russians, and you're beginning to see some unsettling right now with Julia Tymoshenko beginning to kind of depart a little bit from Yushchenko's policies on the Russian fleet and the status of the Crimea. There are a lot of really dangers to existing NATO treaty commitments in the Baltic. These are NATO members, which we have to contemplate, and we have a situation where NATO may be far from unified because Germany in particular gets most of its energy, its gas from Russia, and may well feel itself distanced from the rest of the East Europeans and the U.S. With respect to protecting what's at stake here, which is the sovereignty of the Baltic states and the Ukraine.
Yeah. Very complicated question. Can you talk about that?
Yes, briefly. The caller's absolutely right. There are large minorities of Russian speakers in the Baltic states, in particular in Estonia, in Ukraine, which we already mentioned, elsewhere along the periphery of the Russian Federation. As far as Ukraine is concerned, I would say that that would be the country to watch, because it's the settlements, the post-Soviet settlement there is not yet complete. There have been changes, regime changes even. We all remember the recent events when President Yushchenko was elected, came to power. Yulia Tymoshenko, the very glamorous, charismatic, able leader of part of the coalition that took over in Ukraine, is in some ways a figure similar to Saakashvili, a very savvy as far as PR is concerned, with a strong kind of nationalist streak, using Russia as a lever to mobilize public opinion. Putin certainly has been very active and one might, some people argue, aggressive in his pursuit of Russian interests, political interests, economic interests along the periphery of the Russian Federation. But one mustn't discount the fact that the game is played by two sides, and that figures like Tymoshenko or like Saakashvili have also contributed somewhat to this rise in tensions. And just as Putin has used Saakashvili for his own political purposes, Saakashvili has used the Russians for his political purposes.
We just have about 10 minutes left. I have some other callers, and again, I'd like to introduce our guest, Richard Tempest. He is Associate Professor of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the U of I, also Director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center here at the U of I. We're talking about current events in Georgia. We have some other callers. We'll try to get them both, and we'll next talk with someone in also in Urbana. This would be line number 3.
Hello.
Hello. Yes.
Given how much tension has been over, like, Kosovo and missile defense and Georgia getting into NATO, and the fact that Saakashvili visited the White House, am I correct on that, a few months ago? Do you think it likely that he did this without our knowing ahead of time?
Actually, that's fairly likely, because he's his own man, and arguably perhaps that's not always a good thing. He's very able and a highly skilled politician. I think in this case he overstepped, made a mistake. But I certainly don't think that the United States gave him the green light to invade what is, after all, technically part of Georgian territory. One might argue that where the United States has been at fault is taking its eye off the ball where the South Caucasus is concerned, Georgia, Ossetia, and these other conflicts, because of Iraq, Afghanistan, and various other problems. And also perhaps, again, arguably seeing the situation there primarily through the prism of energy supplies. There is a pipeline that runs through Georgian territory from Azerbaijan, an American ally, by the way, through to Turkey, and it carries oil to the west. That pipeline is one that the Russians do not have control over, and they would dearly love to somehow either block it or get some kind of stake or interest in it. Because, of course, among other things, this is about money and oil supplies and energy. And for the Russians, energy is their most important weapon of in this geopolitical game, much more so than their military, which is actually in a fairly modest in terms of size of power.
One of the things that I think Mr. Saakashvili, the government in Georgia, has charged is that they have said that Russia, in a sense, wants to overthrow the government of Georgia. Do you think the Russian interest here, would it be something as bald as that, or would it be that what the Russian government would like would be to have the governments in some of these former Soviet republics that surround it more pliant, have a closer client relationship with Moscow? Is there actually the possibility that the Russians would be thinking of territorial annexation Abkhazia and South Ossetia, it's not that much territory, so I'm not sure as far as the Russian is concerned that it would make that much difference. What do you think long-term is actually the Russian intention here? What would they like to see happen?
I don't think they have a grand plan. They have priorities, and one of their priorities is to reassert their influence, economic, political, military, along the near abroad, along their borders, especially their western and southern borders. But in the case of Saakashvili, I think they would dearly love to see Saakashvili gone. We don't know how this war is going to play out in terms of Saakashvili's support within the country, because right now, of course, he enjoys support. When the debate begins, the discussions ensue, and his opponents point out that he bears a heavy degree of responsibility for the situation as it has arisen since the events of August 7th, it might well be that things will change, or perhaps not. But I think the Russians actually conducted this military political operation, the 7-day war in the aftermath, very professionally, I have to say, that they've actually acted with considerable restraint. Doesn't mean to say that civilians have not been killed and that horrible devastation was not inflicted, because war is always horrible, and words are inadequate to describe what actually occurred there and what was inflicted on by both sides on the civilian population. But relatively speaking, they have acted with restraint. They've stopped. They've made all sorts of pacific noises. At the same time, however, they have indicated that the question of Georgian territorial integrity is under review. Mm. And that implies that South Ossetia might well find itself part of Russia, or at least the Russians like that. One other point to not to forget, Chechnya is not too far away from this scene of the recent events, and also Sochi, the site of the 2018 Winter Olympics, a prestige project where the Russians are concerned, and one that they would very much like to see take place in conditions of total safety, where they can control and the presentation and do something along the lines of what the Chinese did in Beijing.
So, as far as we know, would the people, would the Ossetians in South Ossetia, would they just as soon join with North Ossetia, which is part of Russia but is a semi-autonomous region within Russia? Would they just as soon affiliate with the North Ossetians?
I think that's a fair assumption, although they have made noises about going completely independent. But since they number less than 100,000, I don't think that would be a viable proposition. And I don't think the Russians themselves would want either Abkhazia or South Ossetia to be independent, because that would make them less controllable. It's natural for them to want to join up with their northern counterparts.
One more caller here at least. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about your statement about whether there was a grand design here. You realize Putin has said that the destruction of the Soviet Union is the greatest catastrophe of the last century, and that implies a certain effort to reestablish the Russian Empire before. But besides that, I was wondering if you could edify us a little bit about what has been going on in the Georgian villages, which in southern Ossetia. My understanding is that a lot of the houses have been bulldozed. There has been a lot of southern Ossetians rising up or instigated by the Russian forces or whatever, or permitted by the Russian forces to get rid of, depopulate these territories. And also, do you have any indications that the Russians are actually leaving Georgia? Indication so far is that the Russians seem to be digging in, which in my mind, kind of augurs for either a regime change and or the closure of the oil pipelines through Georgia, which have effectively been closed anyway since Azerbaijan has rerouted a lot of oil towards the north, and the Central Asian states have followed suit.
Yeah, and we have about 2 minutes left.
Right. Unfortunately, it does seem to be the case that ethnic cleansing is taking place, is occurring in South Ossetia, and the South Ossetian separatists are expelling, physically evicting ethnic Georgians from that territory. This is, unfortunately, the terrible, brutal logic of these kinds of conflicts. We're familiar with it, with this kind of logic at, of course, great remove, great distance in the former Yugoslavia. As far as Russian withdrawals, reports are contradictory. There are some reports of Russian troops beginning to leave, but there are also, I saw this morning the BBC World News report where showed Russian troops dug in some 20 miles outside of Tbilisi, the Georgian capital. However, I do think that eventually the Russians will withdraw, from South Ossetia, but from much of the Georgian territory they have occupied, because as far as their interests are concerned, they've made the point, and it is about, essentially, South Ossetia, not about Georgia per se. They don't want to occupy Georgia. They want to bend Georgia to their geopolitical will.
Mm. Well, this now has a complicated and already complicated relationship between Russia and the United States. May indeed, as we have talked about earlier, end up being an election issue this time around, as people are starting to – here and there, people are starting to talk about return of the Cold War and all that sort of thing. Just does this – given the fact that already there was some tension in the relationship between the U.S. and the Russia, does this really make things that much more difficult?
It changes the tone. I do not actually believe that a new Cold War is about to ensue because of this or because of other developments. First of all, there is no ideological driving force behind Russian foreign policy or intervention in Georgia and elsewhere. Russia is playing a very 19th century kind of game. A great power competing, as they see it, against other great powers. They believe in a sort of zero-sum game. My advantage is your disadvantage. Competing with spheres of influence. It's realpolitik. It's the time of Prime Minister Gladstone, Alexander III, the Emperor of Russia, the kind of mid to late 19th century. And there are economic reasons why the West and Russia will be joined together. Russians travel a great deal. Russia is an immeasurably freer country than it was under the Soviets, even though Putin's regime is much more authoritarian and restrictive than what they had under Yeltsin. But I don't think a new Cold War is inevitable, or indeed likely.
There we must leave it for right now, because we're here at the end of the time. I want to say thanks to our guest, Richard Tempest. He is the Associate Professor of Slavic Languages and Literatures and is Director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much for being
Thank
here.
Thank you.
This program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers 4 area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the afternoon magazine, tea, quinine, azaleas, rhododendrons. For these substances and plants and many others, we owe thanks to botanical explorers of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. They braved all manner of dangers. Coming up today on the afternoon magazine, Celeste Quinn, the host, will explore their exploits and contributions following the 1 o'clock news. The guest will be John Gribben, a co-author of the recent book Flower Hunters. So that's coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. It gets underway at noon here on AM 580. Coming up in just a bit here, we'll have the second hour of Focus 580. Before that, though, an update on the markets and news, so please stay tuned.
Thank you very much, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where this morning we got the final yield on the national estimates from the John Deere Pro Farmer Crop Tour. For corn, the estimate comes in at 153.3 bushels to the acre, and the soybean estimate of yield is at 39.95 BPA. There's a suggestion among the tour participants that soybeans still have a chance to improve, but only if the weather improves down the stretch and there is no early frost. ProFarmer puts the U.S. corn production for the national at 12.152 billion bushels and the soybean output at 2.930 billion bushels. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars at the Chicago Board of Trade, where prices on the screen are showing a lot of red today. It appears that traders are not in a comfortable mind frame to perhaps go home with a long position.